From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For 9 months, Mark Etherington was a governor in a southern province of Iraq, working under the Coalition Provisional Authority during the occupation. His small, poorly equipped team attempted to establish order and help in reconstruction, an almost impossible job. His compound was attacked by the army of the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, and there weren't enough coalition troops to protect them. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Etherington about his new memoir, Revolt on the Tigris, the al-Sadr Uprising, and the Governing of Iraq. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of the 1951 film adaptation of Offenbach's opera, The Tales of Hoffmann. The film is by the British team Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to better understand why it's been so difficult to create a democracy in Iraq, consider what my guest Mark Etherington has to say. For 9 months, he worked with the Coalition Provisional Authority as the governor of a province in the south of Iraq. He reported to the head of the CPA, Paul Bremer, who we heard from on yesterday's program. Etherington has a new memoir called Revolt on the Tigris, The Al-Sadr Uprising, and the Governing of Iraq. It's in part about how his compound was attacked by the army led by the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Etherington is a British civilian who's an expert in post-conflict reconstruction. He worked with the European Community's Monitor Mission in the former Yugoslavia during the war and has subsequently worked in Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, and Afghanistan. First, I'd like to ask you to describe your job.
I was appointed by the Coalition Provisional Authority, in other words, the authority led by Ambassador Bremer that ran Iraq after the end of the maneuver war. And I was basically the governorate coordinator, or what's known as the governorate coordinator, which was de facto his representative in Wasit province, which is a province some 2 hours southeast of Baghdad, the capital, right up alongside the Iranian border. So my job really was to oversee that province on his behalf during the period in which we were administering Iraq.
Now, you write in your memoir that the task you had taken on seemed to you to demand an assertion of personal and national principles that in the 21st century verged on arrogance. You were concerned about assuming a quasi-colonial position. Can you talk about some of your concerns there?
Yes, of course. It felt ironic. Actually, I had been brought up in Kuwait, just a few hundred miles to the south, where my father had worked for the oil company on behalf of British Petroleum. And so actually, I was reasonably familiar with the area. And I guess one could describe Kuwait as, of the time of my childhood, as essentially colonial in character. And of course, as Britain had retreated from empire in the late 19th century particularly, and the early part of the 20th, we had also, I think, turned our backs on it. Obviously, no one really expected to be placed in a role, in the kind of role that was characterized by our mandate post-maneuver war in 2003. So I suppose I felt that cargo of guilt almost. It seemed an improbable role for a sort of middle-aged Brit to suddenly be administering a province in Iraq, and it felt doubly ironic, I suppose, that I had often travelled through that way with my parents as we used to drive back to Britain. So there was definitely a sort of cargo there, I think, and it required a little bit of time to adjust to our new roles.
When you assumed your position as a governor in Iraq in October of 2003, the war was much more unpopular in England than it was in the United States. Did you have an opinion of the war when you took your position?
I think, and I hope this doesn't sound too pompous, I had seen a lot of the protests in Britain, and it is very clear now that the war was initiated on a premise that was found to be false, i.e. the notion that there were weapons of mass destruction. This now seems an extremely slender possibility. As I went for my initial briefings in the British Foreign Ministry, I had to push my way through many of these crowds that, of course, besieged the building, or if not besieged it, then surrounded it, certainly. And I think at the time it felt like an uneasy decision, and certainly it was a decision that had been taken by a government in the teeth of considerable opposition. I was to some extent coloured by that, but I think overwhelmingly, and I said I didn't want to sound pompous, overwhelmingly I simply felt as though it was clear that we were in that position. No amount of bargaining was going to get us out of the fact that we now had to put Iraq back together again, and that it was quite clear that that we were going to need help, and I felt that I could help, and I felt that there were others who could also help, and that overwhelmingly, I think, shaped my response.
Would you describe Wasit province, the province that you governed for about a year? When you wrote, when you got there, there was no rule of law, there were no rules, and if there were, there would have been no one to enforce them.
Yes, we. I arrived there in early October, and the only person who had been representing the coalition up to that point for the Coalition Provisional Authority was was my very able American deputy, who remains a State Department officer. I think it's very easy to sort of conjure up in a studio the sweep of the job, the idea that one is governing a province. But actually, when you get down to the detail of it, the raw facts were that there were only two of us in October of 03. It was some months, of course, after the end of the maneuver war. We had a population of a million, just under a million, for whom we were, at least theoretically, wholly responsible. A border with Iran of 145 kilometers, no police force, no institutions, no local capacity at all, really, and a pretty criminal underclass, I think, that had appeared as a result of the fact that we had been unable, and some would say fatally unable, to assert our will in the awkward and very turbulent months following the war. Because really, and I think this is absolutely true, we had no plan worth the name, which is pretty extraordinary. So overwhelmingly, what we saw was that everything really needed fixing. And it was very, very difficult to know where to begin with two of you, typically. And so I think I and my deputy, who, of course, we got to know each other very well during the succeeding months, we spent an awful lot of time trying to work out where to prioritize our efforts and what was the key to this extraordinarily complex problem.
My guest is Mark Etherington, and for about a year he served as governor of a province in southern Iraq, serving under the Coalition Provisional Authority. He's British, and he's written a new memoir called Revolt on the Tigris, the al-Sadr Uprising and the Governing of Iraq. I want to ask you about two of the most controversial decisions that were made by Paul Bremer, who was the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority while you were in Iraq. And one decision was to disband the Iraqi army, and the other was to dismiss Iraqis who had been members of the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's party, to dismiss them from their positions. And this order applied to the top four levels of former Ba'ath members. But it was tens of thousands of people who lost their jobs because of that order. So how did those two controversial decisions affect you as governor of a province in southern Iraq?
Well, I think on the face of it, of course, these were two very difficult decisions, although I don't sit in the camp of those who think those decisions should not necessarily have been taken, because had we not taken them, there would too have been difficulties of a different character. But let me say, first of all, how it affected us. I mean, clearly, Saddam Hussein had an extraordinarily complex and wide-ranging array of security forces of all hues and kinds. It was inconceivable, really, at the time, given the nature of the war that had been prosecuted against Hussein, that this apparatus that had been served to prop him for so long, and served, and I think this is an important point, to persecute pretty thoroughly, particularly the Shia South, could really have remained in place. So it would have required an extraordinary act of salesmanship, I think, political salesmanship, to have persuaded those who had suffered for so long that the apparatus that they had been fighting should remain in place. The difficulty there was, of course, that in dissolving it, even dissolving is probably the right word, of course, wrong word, in the sense that legally, of course, it was dissolved, but it is also true that it simply fell apart, and it would have been quite hard to put it back together again. In dissolving it, of course, one dissolved completely the rule of law apparatus that kept these provinces together. And so what happened was that one had a limbo, a vacuum, in rule of law terms, in which these places were simply unpoliced. And so one had a million-strong population, this sensitive 145-kilometer stretch of border with Iran that was effectively unoccupied by any form of force capable of projecting the rule of law. Now, of course, we had a Ukrainian brigade there, but they were remarkably thinly stretched, and we simply lacked the local capacity really to buttress their efforts. So overwhelmingly, the rule of law was the major deficiency in the provinces we arrived. Now, we can argue, of course, that had the institutions that had provided the rule of law before not been dissolved, then things might have been very different. But I think there were clear political difficulties in retaining them in being. In terms of the Ba'athists, I think much depended on to whom you were talking. The Shia South hated the Ba'ath Party, and indeed they spent most of their time persecuting them and hunting them down. And in the province south of mine. They spent some time hanging them from lampposts. It would have been an extraordinarily difficult magician's act, I think, to persuade them that the Ba'ath Party should have remained in place. There was arguably a compromise possible, that perhaps the cuts should not have gone so deep in removing many of these people. The difficulty was, of course, the Ba'ath Party retained all of the administrative expertise required to run the institutions of the province. So overwhelmingly, we had to try and put the province back together again, but we really had no tools with which to do it. This was the difficulty.
Your security was supposed to be provided by a small Ukrainian brigade. In Paul Bremer's new memoir, he talks about how he told Donald Rumsfeld a couple of times that he felt we needed more troops in Iraq. Did you feel that way too?
I agree entirely with Ambassador Bremer, and I think this was one of the major difficulties that we faced in Iraq. The key to this business is that as one goes in, first of all, you have to project your brand. People need to know what it is you stand for, and they need to be conscious of your particular identity and your profile. One has to project this early. It's important to set the tone. And the reason it's so important is because one has typically a finite period of time in which really to win the consent necessary to prosecute these reforms. Now, our difficulty was that Iraq is a large country, and that we had insufficient numbers of troops to lend the public that sense of security that's so essential. And what that meant is that in villages in my province, for example, they might see a military patrol once a month or something of that order. And this was really not enough for them to feel confident in the kind of role we were trying to play. And what this additionally meant was that it placed a lot of pressure on the military forces there, many of whom hadn't really done this before. Now, of course, although the Ukrainians, and I'm not singling them out for criticism, the Ukrainians, of course, did their best, but I think few would argue that they're very experienced in peacekeeping terms. And this is a peculiarly sophisticated art, this business of capacity building and peacekeeping. In fact, it's more than peacekeeping, it's capacity building as well, it's state building. And so this decision not to send more troops, more American troops, more NATO troops, and obviously much of this was NATO member troops, much of this was forced upon us by the lack of political consensus. This decision cost us very dear, I think. And what it meant was that we were unable really to seize control in the way required and keep it in those vitally sensitive few months following the end of the war.
Was there anything that you could do to ask for more troops?
No, there was not. And I think, although I wasn't particularly conscious of the time of Ambassador Bremer's discussions on the matter, I mean, it's clear in retrospect, and it was clear at the time to me, that we didn't have enough. By then, though, this coalition of the willing so-called had been formed, and in the area in which I served, in the South Central area, this was a Polish-led area, and actually the American troops that had previously been positioned there had been withdrawn.
My guest is Mark Etherington. He's written a memoir about his experiences during the occupation of Iraq, serving as the governor of an Iraqi province. The memoir is called Revolt on the Tigris. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Etherington. From October 2003 through June 2004, he served under the Coalition Provisional Authority as the governor of a province in the south of Iraq. He's written a new memoir called Revolt on the Tigris. Now, you write that not only weren't there enough military troops backing you up and keeping the Iraqis secure, the police were virtually dysfunctional in the province that you governed under the CPA. You write you couldn't even rely on the police to secure a gas station. What were some of the problems you faced with the police?
I think it comes back again to this very vexed issue of the rule of law. Because we had dismantled, and I think for good reasons, one can revisit the issue, but there were good reasons for dismantling the existing apparatus. Once the Ba'ath Party had been the Ba'ath Party's hold on the institutions of government had been removed, once the apparatus that had kept it there had been dissolved, one was left with these vacuums. Now, we had a police force of form, we had a police force of a kind that had been very rapidly trained and put into place in the intervening period before our arrival. The problem was, of course, that it had been done very quickly and that there had been insufficient attention paid to the quality of the individual. Now, again, I'm not casting blame on the people who must have performed a difficult job, had been forced to perform a difficult job at high speed. There were huge difficulties, I think, in deciding who to recruit into forces like this, because Iraqi society is very, very different to our own. It was very hard to screen such people, very hard to know who to turn to for advice. It was not easily possible to turn to a senior Iraqi society figure and say, who would you recommend for the police? Because he or she would have their own particular views that were born essentially of tribal liaisons rather than a sense of the greater good. So the huge difficulty we had was that there was a police force of a kind. They had been, because they represented their society, so they were feudal in nature. They owed their allegiance to various individuals and not to a sense of a national police force. And this was a problem that was to dog us throughout our time there.
Will you tell us one story where you finally got money to buy guns for members of the police force, and a lot of the police sold the guns on the black market? Why would they do that?
Yeah, that's quite true. And it's to do, I think, with, I mean, firstly, corruption, clearly, but secondly, to do with the rather peculiar notions we encountered in the force. When the police were given their weapons, which had taken months to procure, many of them saw them as gifts, as a sort of reward for high performance, which was risible, actually, given the circumstances, and they simply sold them on the weapons market. I think part of this, when one spoke to Iraqis about this, the extraordinary corruption that existed in our province and others, it was simply because faith in government had been so substantially shaken that the theft of government resources, of government equipment and of government money was regarded as a form of was regarded as a perfectly reasonable act, because faith in the institutions that had generated these things was long gone.
Now, your background is in reconstruction of countries. You know, you worked in the Balkans. What are some of the other countries you worked in rebuilding democracy? Yeah,
I began work in the former Yugoslavia during the war of 92-95. Mm-hmm. And from then, I think many of us went on to Kosovo and to Serbia and Palestine and Afghanistan and many of the places that have suffered to some degree or another from the kind of problems we encountered.
Did you feel that the leadership of the Coalition Provisional Authority, including Paul Bremer, had sufficient experience in this kind of rebuilding of countries?
Not necessarily. I think in some cases they did. And actually, in the main, I was impressed by the leadership of the Coalition Provisional Authority. I think what dogged us particularly was the fact that we didn't seem really to have a formed plan. We were unable to inject power and presence into these vacuums I spoke of early enough, which meant that much of Iraq, particularly in the areas where there were less experienced troops, failed really to understand where we were going. And the man in the streets, so-called, I think, lacked confidence that we were able to keep he and his family secure. This was the overarching difficulty. So my own feeling was that the Coalition Provisional Authority was really locked in logistic rather than ideological struggle in the early months when I was there, just trying to compensate for the lack of a plan and really try to generate one on the hoof. And that clearly is not the way to do what remains a very complex enterprise.
It was not only didn't have enough troops to keep the Iraqi people in your province secure, there weren't enough troops to protect you and the people who worked with you through the Coalition Provisional Authority. The main insurgent in your area was Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric. He had set up his own courts and prisons. Was he doing that in your province?
We believe so, certainly anecdotally, although we never found any evidence to support it. Certainly it was the case in cities further to our west. one of the principal difficulties here was that he was able very effectively to exploit our own confusion and unpreparedness, and was able to act pretty effectively as an opposition group. Now, he, along with his supporters, articulated fairly early a fairly potent manifesto based on Islamic tenets, based on opposition to what he termed the occupation, and based really on criticism of our own shortcomings. And these were easy charges to make: how we distributed scarce resources, why we allowed what he called a corrupt police force to remain in power. And this became a real thorn in our side. When the rebellion of early April 2004 occurred, we were completely unprepared for it. I think largely because, firstly, we did not anticipate the rebellion itself, and secondly, we underestimated his popular appeal. I think if there were a third error we made, is that we underestimated their military capability.
Mark Etherington served as the governor of a province in Iraq during the occupation. His new memoir is called Revolt on the Tigris, the al-Sadr Uprising and the Governing of Iraq. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mark Etherington tells us about surviving the attack on his compound by the army of the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of the 1951 film version of the Offenbach opera, The Tales of Hoffmann. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Etherington. During the occupation of Iraq, he served as the governor of the Wasit province in the south of Iraq. He was appointed by the Coalition Provisional Authority, whose director, Paul Bremer, was our guest yesterday. Etherington is an expert in post-conflict reconstruction. He's written a memoir called Revolt on the Tigris, The al-Sadr Uprising and the Governing of Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr is a radical Shiite cleric. Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, closed down a newspaper that was published by Muqtada al-Sadr, in which al-Sadr attacked the CPA, he attacked Paul Bremer, he called for violence. What were the after effects in your province?
Well, they were very rapid. The paper was closed and one of his deputies was arrested. And we had had some discussion previously with their leader in our province, although I had always refused personally to meet him because I felt that that should be a carrot, if you like, something that should reward a certain pattern of behavior. We had had nothing but trouble from he and his militia in Kut, the capital of Wasit province. What happened, though, I think startled us all, that very shortly after the closure of the paper, within a matter of days, in fact, and the arrest of his deputy, a demonstration occurred outside our compound in which they demanded basically the reopening of the paper and the release of the deputy. It was really an unusual day. We met the leaders ultimately inside our compound, and it was clear to us from the outset really that there was no negotiation possible with them. It was very clear they had a very concrete manifesto, that there was really no negotiation to be had between the two of us, no narrowing of what was a pretty profound ideological gap. But I think even though we realized that during that discussion, that very tough discussion, the suddenness with which their onslaught occurred surprised us all.
In retrospect, do you think it was a bad decision to shut down his newspaper, or do you think that that needed to be done?
It is very, very difficult to decide how best to proceed in instances like this. What we know as hate speech, in other words, a newspaper or a media forum that promotes hatred, incites criminal behavior, is never going to be an easy bedfellow when one is trying to build democratic structures. Having said that, of course, democracy itself demands a certain element of free speech, so it's very tough. It may have been the wrong decision. Now we understand how capable Muqtada al-Sadr's militia actually were, in the sense that we were not ready for the rebellion that followed. But I don't think anybody predicted at the time that this would itself be enough to spark armed rebellion. And even if we had predicted that, I don't think we'd have predicted the raw capability, actually, that his militia displayed in the succeeding days.
So you were describing that after Paul Bremer of the Coalition Provisional Authority shut down Muqtada al-Sadr's newspaper, al-Sadr organized a revolt and attacked your compound. Would you describe the attack that you came under?
Yes, and I remember pretty clearly we had always taken security pretty seriously, and I was fortunate in the sense that my deputy was a former officer in the U.S. Army, and I myself had had some military experience. Well, there are also others with military experience on the compound, and this stood us in good stead. The rebellion, when it came, happened very suddenly. The compound came under mortar attack, and then had a whole series of rocket-propelled grenades fired into it. And then we were later machine gunned, and the entire period probably lasted for a period of some 14 hours, I would say. I think what was particularly striking at the time was just how quickly the institutions, the very fragile institutions we had started to build, fell apart. The police were nowhere to be seen. The civil defense groupings that we had formed again vanished. People failed to come to work. The very raw institutions, the nascent early institutions of provincial government, simply ceased to exist. And it became very clear to me at the time that our hold on the province was tremendously fragile, not necessarily because we were walking the wrong avenue, but because we had underestimated, in a sense fatally underestimated, the hold that people like Muqtada al-Sadr had over the ordinary Iraqi. And so what occurred, I think, in those early hours was that the province was literally paralyzed by this rebellion, which spread very, very quickly across the rest of the south. We couldn't move out of our compound. We were unable to communicate with the aircraft that had been sent to assist because we lacked the communications equipment to do so. And ultimately, in retrospect, of course, we were not in any way prepared to be placed in that kind of position. But then arguably, of course, the Coalition Provisional Authority was not constructed for this kind of thing. More importantly, perhaps, it was quite clear that the troops locally, our own troops, our Ukrainian troops, and more broadly than that, the Polish-led division of which they were a part, really weren't set up for this either. They had come to keep the peace, and what they were now in was really a war-fighting situation, and very few of the armies present in Iraq, with the exception, of course, of the US Army and the British, were really set up for that kind of campaign.
You had to decide whether to evacuate or not. How did you decide what to do?
Well, we didn't want to evacuate, although clearly it was a very tense time, and we had no way of knowing how it would end. Actually, a number of compounds were later attacked, but we were among the first, and so there was really nothing to compare the situation to. We merely saw at the time how awkward a precedent it would set if a militia, however well armed, however well prepared, however well led, were able to evict a coalition team and, if not defeat, then certainly circumvent the troops present in the province. So we were very, very conscious of what an enormous setback this would be. And so we were not at all keen to leave, even though the situation, of course, was a very difficult one. We were wholly unable to hold the compound because we had insufficient troops to do so. The compound was too large. And our own security details, our close protection details, had already been in a firefight on the roof for some time. We believed that some form of rescue attempt would be possible. That ultimately was not possible. And we were told to evacuate in the early hours of the next day, which we did in convoy, with great reluctance, because I think we were all conscious of the political damage we felt might be caused.
Well, you also write that you felt like a coward after you evacuated.
I think we all felt pretty humiliated. Of course, when one is given this job of governing a province and one assembles a team to do it, together with, of course, the pronouncements we had all made about the democratic process, about where we had hoped Iraq would go, it's clear that despite all of this firepower, despite, you know, the 160,000 US troops present in the country, the 10,000 British troops to our south, despite all of the air power available to us, despite all the technological advantages, clearly to contemplate them withdrawing from a compound, having made all of these public pronouncements after an attack by militia, was a pretty difficult pill to swallow.
So you evacuated, you returned after a month and reassumed authority, which it must have been hard to do.
It was very difficult to do because, and here I speak very personally, I felt embarrassed. I felt as though I had failed, that I had deluded myself about what we had achieved in the province. I'd felt that we'd been evicted by a sort of ragtag militia. I felt that we should never have gone. And now to go back under those circumstances was pretty embarrassing. What was most striking, though, is that, and incidentally, my American deputy was sent back far sooner than the British team was. My American deputy had told me that actually was not the case, that there was still much to be achieved. And I have to be honest, I mean, despite our excellent relationship, I rather doubted him. I was much more conscious of the reverse that we had suffered. What was very striking, though, is just how unsuccessful the Saddam militia themselves had been. They, in a sense, were trying to motivate the same middle-class group in my province, in our province, that we had been courting. And this middle class had effectively vanished from the political scene. They wanted no more politicking. They just wanted to stay at home, their heads below the parapet with their families. They were scared. They were fatigued by years of oppression and war, and they just wanted to get on with their own lives. So they really didn't want much to do with us, and I had always taken that pretty personally. But actually what became very clear on our return is they hadn't wanted anything to do with Sada either. And so Sada had been just as unable to move this invisible middle class forward as we had. So Sada actually had failed completely to gather the kind of public support they required. And so as we went back, actually we found we were able to put together province institutions much more quickly than I had originally feared.
My guest is Mark Etherington. He's written a memoir about his experiences during the occupation of Iraq, serving as the governor of an Iraqi province. The memoir is called Revolt on the Tigris. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Etherington, and he was the governor of a southern province in Iraq for about a year under the coalition provisional authority. He's written a new memoir called Revolt on the Tigris, The Al-Sadr Uprising and the Governing of Iraq. Looking back now on your experiences in Iraq and looking at what the situation is now, what do you think is the wisdom of invading a country like Iraq that has a long history of dictatorship and trying to transform it into a democracy?
I think this is a very difficult question to answer. My personal view is that these difficulties we've encountered, these terrible difficulties, are merely the characteristics of this kind of game. There is no easy way to pick up a country like Iraq, to change its economy from a central to a market economy, to change its leadership, to change its political system, to do all of this in 2 or 3 years, and then to walk away again. The idea that this was ever going to be easy is an extraordinary notion, and in a sense merely reinforces the extraordinary naivety that exists in the world about what is required in this kind of endeavor. I cannot see, though, that these kind of difficulties should necessarily militate against us trying it. If you were to speak to any member or any number of members of the Shia in the South, where I served at the time, you would hear nothing but praise for what had been done. It is wrong to conflate the aims of the insurgency and the attacks they carry out with general popular opinion. If you look at the turnout for these public polls at the most recent elections, staggeringly high numbers, one sees a different Iraq that one doesn't necessarily see in this endless sequence of tragic attacks, particularly on American soldiers. So should we carry on doing this kind of thing? Yes, I believe we should. I believe it's our duty to do so. Should we do it in a much better way? Yes, I believe we should certainly do that, and we have to learn these lessons. This is a science. It is not something one can simply walk into. It requires detailed planning. It requires an experienced cadre of people to do this kind of work.
What's the best way, do you think, of finding an exit strategy?
Well, we hold our nerve. That's my personal opinion, and I have stuck to it since I served there. We have a political process still. That in itself is a pretty extraordinary achievement given the pressures on us. We have retained that political process throughout. All members, all groups of Iraq still feel there is credibility in that process. They still feel that the government is something they wish to be part of. They still feel they should take part in elections. They still feel the need to debate with one another about the future shape of the country. This, to me, is an enormous achievement. So the exit strategy is to stick with it. Now, clearly, America particularly has had to pay a terrible price for this. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the strategy was wrong. Could we have done it better? Certainly. We now have to hold our nerve. Troop withdrawals are now planned. Iraqi institutions need to be strengthened. It's going to be a bumpy ride. It has been a tumultuous ride. But I don't see that there was ever any substitute for it.
The larger goal of invading Iraq, as described by the Bush administration, was that Iraq was a front in the war on terror, and this would help the war against terrorism. Your experiences watching the insurgency grow, did that lead you to think that this was helpful or not helpful, finally, in the war against terrorism?
I think the jury has to remain out on whether this was a front in the war on terror. I'm not sure there's much evidence to support the notion. There's more evidence to support the notion that this actually was a homegrown rebellion created to some extent by our shortcomings and complemented, I think, by other agendas.
Do you think that Iraq is like attracting terrorists and creating more terrorists, as some critics of the war say?
I think that's entirely possible, and I think the evidence supports it. We have created targets there, but the difficulty is that these two events, the state-building effort in Iraq and the fight against the insurgents, the growing insurgency, have now become conflated to be one. They're not. They're two very separate issues, and the one doesn't mean that we should not prosecute the other, in other words, the state-building in the country.
What was the last thing you did before leaving Iraq?
Well, to be honest with you, and I know it sounds rather romantic, I buried a box full of mementos in the garden for my children because I cling to the hope, not least because I spent my childhood just south of there. I cling to the hope that they'll be able to go back there with me one day. I'll be able to visit my Iraqi friends. And I hope very much, very sincerely, that it'll be a peaceful place and that the friends I knew then will look back on it and say that however difficult, it had been worthwhile.
Just one more question. The United States that kind of led the charge into Iraq intentionally did not go through the United Nations. Now, when you worked in the former Yugoslavia, you were there as part of a group that was organized by the United Nations. Has it made you have the two different experiences made you think about the pros and cons of being part of a larger UN-led mission?
The overwhelming advantages, and I'll put aside the legal arguments which must be carried out by people better versed in it than me, the overwhelming advantages are of a broad coalition in prosecution of this kind of thing. Our disadvantage in Iraq was that it was essentially a narrowly led coalition, and this opened us to criticism, made it, if you like, an American war, quotation marks at each end. It's ironic that as I went into Iraq to take up my duties, I imagined that this very narrow coalition actually would be advantageous to us, because I think all of us have been fatigued by the bureaucracy that tends to attach itself to large missions and occasionally large UN missions. So we felt it would be a leaner partnership. As it is, we relearn that these things are pretty difficult and that we need to learn the lessons like anyone else.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, no, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Mark Etherington served as the governor of an Iraqi province during the occupation. His new memoir is called Revolt on the Tigris, the al-Sadr Uprising and the Governing of Iraq. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, the film adaptation of the Offenbach opera The Tales of Hoffman is out on DVD, and Lloyd Schwartz has a review. This is Fresh Air. One of opera's best-loved fantasies, Jacques Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffman, has captivated audiences for more than a century. The 1951 film version by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger has just come out on DVD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
I was very young when I got hooked on opera. Before I was in my teens, I was captivated by the live radio broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera and TV shows like The Bell Telephone Hour and The Voice of Firestone, where famous opera singers were featured. One of the first operas to capture my imagination was Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann, with its glittering doll song, its seductive barcarolle, its singing statue and scary villains. The opera was based on both the real life and the fantastical tales of the German romantic writer E.T.A. Hoffmann. Offenbach was primarily a composer of French operettas, but in Hoffmann he was trying something more ambitious, four stories about Hoffmann's own doomed romances. Sadly, Offenbach died just before he completed his masterpiece. Controversies still exist about exactly what his final intentions were. But these complex issues dissolve in a good production, like the bewitching version filmed in 1951, conducted by the great Sir Thomas Beecham, and written, produced, and directed by the British team of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, who had previously made the ultimate fantasy about ballet, The Red Shoes. As Martin Scorsese points out in his commentary on the marvelous new Criterion DVD, this was the first opera actually conceived as a film. We even hear the orchestra tuning up, as if the theater were inside our own heads, preparing us for the disorienting events to come. Powell and Pressburger's inspired idea was to transform Offenbach's opera into a ballet. Most of the characters are played by dancers lip-syncing the words in English to off-screen singing. Two of the objects of Hoffmann's desire, the dancer Stella, in the original she's an opera star, and the doll Coppelia, are both played by the radiant ballerina Moira Shearer, star of The Red Shoes. All four of Hoffmann's menacing nemeses are danced by the outstanding British character dancer Robert Helpman. The choreography is by the great Frederick Ashton, who dances several comic roles himself. British actress Pamela Brown, with the voice of mezzo-soprano Monica Sinclair, plays the gender-bending trouser role of Niklaus, Hoffmann's concerned assistant. The whole film is a fiendish hall of mirrors. The production is a bizarre mixture of sinister surrealism and movie magic, filmed in intense, supersaturated Technicolor, splendidly restored on the new DVD. My favorite episode is about Coppelia, the mechanical doll Hoffmann thinks is human because he sees her through special glasses. The doll's dazzling coloratura aria is Offenbach's satiric comment on operatic vocalism.
Oh!
During Hoffman's wild waltz with Coppelia, his rose-colored glasses break, and he finally realizes the devastating truth. The angry dollmaker tears his creation to pieces, but Coppelia's body parts keep moving even after they've been severed. On the DVD, George Romero, the director of Night of the Living Dead, talks about the powerful influence this film had on him. Though the scholarly disputes over Offenbach's intentions persist even today, Powell and Pressburger not only keep us visually mesmerized, they also make unsettling sense of this opera about how easily mesmerized we all are by love and by irresistible, unforgettable music.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the 1951 film version of Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffman on a Criterion Collection DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. From the Everett Foundation, working with the nonprofit Medicare Rights Center in support of Medicare for All, online at medicarerights.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1961, an integrated group of civil rights activists rode by bus through the Deep South, challenging segregation. On the next Fresh Air, Raymond Arsenault discusses his new book about the Freedom Riders. And from the archive, we hear from their leader, the late James Farmer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.